Picture a lake bed in the high desert, Mojave, California. It's early, cold, the kind of morning where the air is so still you can hear a jet turbine spooling up a mile away. And on that ramp sits something that does not make sense at first glance. A long, spindly aircraft with two booms and a tall twin tail, and slung underneath its belly, a fat little rocket ship with round portholes, painted white, wearing a spray of red stars. That little rocket ship is about to go to space, and it's going to do it by first taking off like an airplane. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Vector, and this is Clear Direct, the show where we take the machines that make you stop and stare, and we figure out how they actually work. Today we are talking about Spaceship One, not as a history lesson, as an engineering story. Because more than 20 years later, the ideas Burt Rutan baked into that airframe are still the reason we talk about them at Oshkosh at all. And there is no better week to tell it. Because if you walk the home-built rows here at AirVenture right now, you will trip over Burt Rutan's fingerprints. Those swept little canards with the wing in the back and the small wing up front. The very Eze, the long easy airplanes people built in their garages out of foam and fiberglass, because one man proved you could. The same man who then turned around and built a spaceship. Let's break this down. This segment is supported by AviationSoul.com. They make aviation challenge coins that mark the real milestones. First solo, private pilot, instrument rated, CFI, the whole journey, one coin at a time. Beautifully made, heavy in the hand, built to last a career. If you've ever wanted something more permanent than a logbook stamp to mark the day it all changed, take a look, AviationSoul.com. So start with the problem, why is getting to space so hard? It is not strictly the altitude. The edge of space, the line most people use, sits at 100 kilometers up. That's about 330,000 feet. High, yes, but a rocket doesn't burn most of its fuel climbing. It burns it going fast, sideways. To reach orbit, you have to accelerate to roughly 17,500 miles an hour. That's the real mountain. That is why orbital rockets are giant columns of fuel that throw 90% of their own weight overboard on the way up. Here's what most people miss. Spaceship One was never trying to go to orbit. It was a suborbital ship up to the line. A few minutes of weightlessness, and back down. That single decision changed everything about the engineering, because it meant the vehicle didn't need to go 17,000 miles an hour. It needed to go about three times the speed of sound, straight up, and then it could just fall back home. And once you've decided you only need to touch space and return, a whole set of clever airplane ideas suddenly become possible. That's the Rutan move. He didn't build a small rocket. He built an airplane that happened to fly a rocket profile. Let's take the three big ideas one at a time. The air launch, the hybrid motor, and the piece that made everybody's jaw drop. The feathering wing first, the air launch. Spaceship One did not blast off from a pad. It was carried up under a purpose-built airplane called White Knight, a twin jet with an enormous wingspan and a spidery, high-altitude look to it. White Knight hauled the spaceship up to about 50,000 feet, then it let go. Think about what that gives you for free. At 50,000 feet, you are already above roughly 85% of the atmosphere. The air is thin, drag is low, you've skipped the densest, most punishing part of the climb, the part where a ground-launched rocket wastes enormous energy, just bullying through thick air. And the rocket didn't have to lift itself off the ground, standing still, which is the least efficient moment in any launch. It got dropped into clean air, already moving. The carrier plane did the boring, expensive, low-altitude work with cheap, reusable jet engines burning ordinary jet fuel. The data tells an interesting story here. Air launch is one of those ideas that looks obviously smart and yet keeps running into hard limits. It works beautifully for something small and suborbital. It gets very difficult when you scale up, because now your carrier aircraft has to be monstrous to lift a real orbital rocket, and monstrous airplanes are their own nightmare. But for what Spaceship One was trying to do, air launch was exactly right. Elegant, reusable, reversible, if something went wrong. Second idea, the engine. And this is my favorite because it's a genuinely different kind of rocket motor and most pilots have never heard how it works. Rockets basically come in two families, solid motors which are like a giant firework. You pack solid propellant into a tube, you light it, and it burns until it's done. Simple, powerful, and utterly uncontrollable. Once it's lit, you are a passenger. You cannot throttle it, you cannot shut it off. It burns, then you have liquid motors. Two liquids, a fuel and an oxidizer pumped together and burned. Those you can throttle, you can stop, you can restart. but they are plumbing nightmares, turbo pumps, valves, cryogenic tanks, the whole orchestra, complex and expensive and full of ways to fail. Spaceship One used a third path, a hybrid. Here's the trick. The fuel was a solid, specifically a kind of synthetic rubber, packed into the motor casing as a hollow grain. Just sitting there, it is completely inert. You could hold a match to it and nothing dramatic happens. It is functionally a tube of rubber. The oxidizer was a liquid, nitrous oxide. Yes, the same laughing gas from the dentist's office, stored as a liquid under pressure. To fire the motor, you open a valve and flow the nitrous oxide down through the hollow core of that rubber grain and ignite it. Now the rubber burns furiously, but only because you are feeding it oxidizer, and the instant you want it to stop, you close the valve. No more oxidizer, no more fire. You can shut the engine down. Think about what that buys a test pilot. A solid motor is a commitment. A hybrid is a decision you can revisit every second of the burn. If something feels wrong, you close the valve and you're now flying a glider with a rocket-shaped fuselage. For a program flying human beings on an experimental spaceship, that shutdown capability was not a luxury, it was the safety case. Was the hybrid perfect? No, and I promised you honesty. Hybrids tend to burn a little rough. The combustion can get unstable, and on some flights the ride-up was reportedly a real rattling, cork-screwing handful. Hybrids also deliver less performance per pound than a good liquid engine. There's a reason the biggest orbital rockets don't use them. But for a reusable, human-rated shut-it-down-if-you-need-to-suborbital ship, the hybrid was a brilliant fit. Right tool, right job, okay. Third idea, and this is the one. This is the piece of engineering that I think is genuinely, quietly beautiful. The feathering wing. Here's the problem it solves. Going up is hard, but coming back down is what kills spacecraft. When you fall back into the atmosphere at high speed, you have a tremendous amount of energy to get rid of, and it comes off as heat. That's why capsules need heat shields. That's why the space shuttle wore thousands of fragile tiles. And that's why re-entry demands the vehicle hold exactly the right attitude. Come in at the wrong angle, and you either skip off the atmosphere or you burn up. For most spacecraft, holding that attitude is an active, nervous, constant control problem. The vehicle wants to tumble, and something, a computer, a thruster, a pilot, has to keep fighting it. Rutan looked at that and asked a different question. What if the shape of the vehicle made it want to fall correctly, all by itself? What if re-entry could be a thing the airframe did automatically, with no computer and no pilot skill required? And the answer he came up with is the feather. On the way down, the entire back half of each wing plus the twin tail booms hinges upward. The wings fold up to about 65 degrees, so the ship goes from looking like a sleek airplane to looking like a badminton shuttlecock, or a maple seed, that spinning helicopter seed you threw as a kid that always falls the same stable way. That is exactly the physics. A shuttlecock cannot fly nose first. Throw it any direction you want, and it whips around and comes down heavy end. First, belly to the wind every single time. It self-corrects. It is stable without anyone doing anything. So Spaceship One folds into that shape at the top of its arc, and now it comes down belly first, incredibly draggy, incredibly stable, no computer needed. The high drag means it sheds energy up high in the thin air, gently, so it never gets hot enough to need a heat shield at all. The pilot could, and this is the part that gets me, essentially take his hands off and let the shape do the work. Then, once it's back down into the thick air where wings work again, around 50 or 60,000 feet, the feather folds back down. The ship becomes an airplane again, and the pilot glides it home to that same Mojave runway and rolls to a stop like he just came back from a currency flight. Up like an airplane, out like a rocket, down like a shuttlecock. Home like a glider. Four different machines in one airframe, and the transitions between them are the whole trick. Let me put the timeline on it because it matters. In June of 2004, with a pilot named Mike Melville at the controls, Spaceship One became the first privately built, privately funded crewed vehicle to reach space. Not a government program, not a defense contractor. A team in the desert, then came the prize. The Ansari X Prize, $10 million to the first private team that could fly a crewed craft to 100 kilometers twice inside 2 weeks. The two-flight rule was the point. Anybody can get lucky once. Reusability, turning the same ship around fast, that was the thing the prize was built to force. In late September and early October of 2004, Spaceship One did it. Two flights. Melville on the first, Brian Binney on the second. On that final flight, the ship climbed to roughly 367,000 feet, call it 70 miles up. They won the $10 million, and honestly, the money was almost beside the point. They had proven the model, and here's where I have to be balanced. Because this is clear direct, and I'm not going to sell you the clean version. Spaceship One went into a museum. It hangs today in the Smithsonian in Washington, right next to the Spirit of St. Louis and the Bell X1 fitting company. But the technology went on to a bigger, heavier successor built for Virgin Galactic, and that program hit tragedy. In 2014, a follow-on ship broke apart during a powered test flight, and one of the two pilots, Michael Alsbury, was killed. And the cause cut right to the heart of the very system I just praised. The feather on that flight, the feather was unlocked too early, while the ship was still accelerating through the transonic region, where the aerodynamic loads are brutal. The forces threw the feather up on their own, and the airframe couldn't survive it. Here's the honest lesson, and it's an engineering lesson, not a eulogy. The feather was a genius solution to the problem of coming down, but it introduced a new failure mode that a fixed heat shield simply doesn't have a moving part. A thing that must deploy at exactly the right moment, and absolutely not a second early. Rutan's design traded the heat shield problem for a timing problem. That trade bought enormous elegance. It also carried a cost, and it took a redesign, a mechanical lock that physically cannot release at the wrong speed, before that generation of ship flew people again. That's the whole business right there. There is no free lunch in flight. Every elegant solution is a trade, and the engineer's real job is to understand what you're trading and to respect it. The feather is still one of the cleverest ideas in the history of human spaceflight, and it still demanded to be treated with total discipline. Both of those things are true at once. Now, why am I telling you this from Oshkosh specifically? Because Burt Rutan is not a NASA story. He is an EAA story. He came up through exactly the world you are standing in this week. He built canard homebuilts that regular people welded and glassed together in their garages. He built Voyager, the impossibly skinny airplane that flew around the entire world nonstop, no refueling, back in 1986, with his brother Dick Rutan and Jaina Yeager aboard. And then he built a spaceship and won a $10 million prize with it. The same guy. That is the thread. The experimental, amateur-built, don't-tell-me-it-can't-be-done spirit that fills these rows every July is the exact spirit that put a private citizen into space. AirVenture isn't just a place where you look at airplanes. It's the culture that produced the person who decided a spaceship should land on a runway. So when you walk past a little swept canard parked in the home-built area this week, the one with the wing on backwards and the propeller in the tail, give it a second look. That funny little airplane and the spaceship in the Smithsonian came out of the same mind and the same permission. The permission to look at how everyone else does it, and ask out loud, why not this way instead? My thanks to the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum and to Scaled Composites for the record that makes a story like this possible to tell straight. If you want the links and a few more of these teardowns, they're waiting at radiohanger.com. That's the thing about this field. The distance from a garage in the desert to the edge of space turned out to be shorter than anyone thought. Somebody just had to build the airplane that could make the trip. I'm Vector. Keep looking up and keep asking why not.